Xfinity Mobile is a new kind of network designed to save you money while streaming your favorite music. Like that 90s jams playlist you've played 72 times today. It combines America's largest, most reliable 4G LTE with the most Wi-Fi hotspots. Get up to 5 lines of unlimited nationwide talk and text included with your Xfinity internet at no extra cost. All you pay for is data. Visit an Xfinity store or click now to see how much you can save with Xfinity Mobile. Restrictions apply. Requires Xfinity internet service, equipment, taxes, fees, and other charges extra. Limited to 2 lines pending internet activation.
Your New York weekend is not complete without the Joan Hamburg Show on 77 WABC.
Welcome to the first fall, almost fall edition of the Joan Hamburg Show. We are going to be together today, Saturday, from 1 to 3. And I have such good guests. Marcia Clark talking about OJ, what's going to happen when he's released. We're going to take a look at the fashion world. Are we going to be buying anything? Those great big tall shoes? We'll see. And also new television seasons. I'm very happy to be back. New York City never looked better. And I spent couple of days on the east end of Long Island where I had one of the most scary things that's ever happened to me. I was with my husband driving on a really dark road. We had had a great pre-party with the Clintons and all kinds of interesting people, and we were going for supper with friends when a huge deer came out of nowhere. Couldn't see it, and it hit me on the driver's side, almost destroying that whole side of my car. And really scary because I was driving slowly. I was following someone 20, 25 miles an hour, which, thank goodness, or we could have been curtains. But you can't stop it. This thing leaped in the air, smashed against my window. It was, I said, enough summer adventure for us. On the good side, I had one of the best meals I've had in the Hamptons at MP East. It was a pop-up. It's now closed, but it was Madison Park, which is considered to be one of the best restaurants in the world. Very expensive in New York City, where it's opening in October. But if you're a foodie and you don't mind spending the big bucks, you're certainly going to get your money's worth. And fall means Feast of San Gennaro coming into New York. You can get your cannoli fills, new seasons, new everything. So come on, everyone. A great show right ahead, and you're always part of it.
New York culture with real New Yorkers. Joan Hamburg, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
Welcome, everyone, to the Joan Hamburg Show. You know, I was thinking after I finished Marcia Clark's, maybe this is the third in the series that she's been doing, criminal defense attorney Samantha Brinkman. It's called Snap Judgment. But I kept thinking, when the OJ trial reached its shocking conclusion, and it's been on all of our minds because television has been running the specials that they've done about this. I wonder if Marcia Clark then ever thought she was going to come out of this not only whole, but enormously successful, best-selling author, practice if she wants, criminal lawyer, and also now involved in what's going to be big television based on her books. So, Marcia, you had a lot of dreams when you were a kid, but was being a writer in that group?
It really was. It really was. I loved crime fiction from the time I was a little kid. I was a fan of Nancy Drew and the Harvey Boys.
I love that, too. That was the best.
It was. So, you know, but I just didn't believe that, you know, it was something that you could do to make a living, and I didn't think I'd ever realize the dream. So, yeah, the fact that I'm actually doing that now, incredible to me. No, I would never have predicted it.
Right, and the fact that you survived. It's such a great life story, that trial, which we still think about, and with its amazing, shocking, horrible conclusion. But that you not only got through that, but went on to do so many amazing things, too.
It's not something I would have predicted, Joan.
I know. You had to survive it.
I had to. You know, there was, of course I was miserable. Of course it was a terrible time after the trial and during the trial. Terrible. But at some point, you know, afterwards, you know, I just thought, I can't just crawl into a hole and, you know, and let this destroy me. And I had to find a way to survive and live. And of course I had two little children. Who were at home with me, and I thought, I'm gonna live. Yeah, I'm gonna do it.
and you did it. And to this day, even after the television specials, by the way, of which Marcia Clark came off wonderfully well, do you still, you still think he's guilty?
Well, of course.
Of course, right.
And I think nothing changed to not make me believe it, but whatever has transpired since the trial has only made me believe it more. And by the way, I thought that he was supposed to be looking for the killer.
Right. His excuse, right, is that he's been in jail, hard to look.
Yeah. No, but he was not in jail. He had years before that, mm-hmm. and I didn't think he was working all that hard, unless you think he was going to find the killer on a golf course.
Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting to see what happens to him once he gets out, exactly, and whether his loving family is going to be so welcoming.
Yeah, we will see. I mean, some of them certainly will be, but we'll see if he's able to keep it together now.
I'm talking to Marcia Clark, whose latest thriller is called Snap Judgment. And this is about topics that you read about all the time. Human trafficking, which is a terrible problem worldwide, and revenge porn. Now, you know, I never really thought about that until you made this one of the major themes of your new novel. It's the story of this lovely young woman whose dad is a very prominent and wealthy lawyer, a litigator, and they find this kid who's a freshman in college with her throat slashed. And then you go on with the ex-boyfriend whom she was trying to get rid of, and he's the one who put the stuff up on the porn sites, so he was the obvious suspect in this.
Right, the obvious suspect, because he was the obsessive guy who was stalking her and abusive to her because she broke up with him. And then the revenge porn appears, along with a posting about, help me enjoy my rape fantasy, which leads to her being assaulted and sends her down the rabbit hole and into a depression. And she feels like her life is ruined. And then she winds up with her throat slashed in the bathtub. And the boyfriend is the prime suspect. But 3 days later, he turns up dead himself. At that point, the girl's father is the primary suspect, because who is more likely to have killed the boy who killed his daughter, right?
Revenge his daughter.
In the neighborhood, yeah.
And then we're not going to, because a thriller, you have to go along for the thrill and the ride, but a lot of things come out in this book as Marcia's character, who's a very complicated woman, Samantha Brinkman. She's not just some little pretty face.
No.
She's got a lot of her own issues. And as she comes, it does all the work she does with her investigator into this, these maybe murders, two of them. A lot of things that she had sort of pushed in her past come to light, too.
Right, exactly. She has a traumatic past. And she, in this book now, it started to get in blood defense. She meets the father she had never known. She was raised by a single mother, and she, in blood defense, met that father for the first time. And now in Snap Judgment, the latest book in the series, they are starting to find their way. Her father is a detective in the Los Angeles Police Department, which is kind of ironic because she hates police, and they have a very interesting relationship, but they do find themselves working together in some respect, and she calls on him for help, which he does not appreciate because, of course, she's working for the other side.
And you gave her some mother. Your character there.
The mother is not a good guy in this. So, yeah, you know, I want to make sure I'm evenly balanced, and girls and boys are both good and bad, so that there's no one side particularly that You can say, oh, all the men are terrible or all the girls are terrible. But no, there's a little of each, and everybody's nuanced. Nobody's an angel in these books. And yeah, her mother is a real piece of work, and not what you'd call the ideal mother at all.
No.
In fact, very far from it. And so she had no real parent. She had no real father. Her mother was not anything to write home about. And then when she finally does meet her father as an adult, she has a hard time trusting anyone, and she has a hard time letting him in. So it's very slow crawl towards each other and very fraught with two steps forward, three steps back.
And really real. And Marcia, not only a best-selling author over these years, but when she started her career in law, she started as a criminal defense attorney and then became a prosecutor in the DA's office in L.A. And as you know, she was the lead prosecutor for the O.J. Simpson murder trial. And now she's going to be coming forth with her own TV stuff based on Samantha Brinkman. What's going on with that?
Well, Samantha Brinkman, we actually, ABC Studios optioned the series of Blood Defense based on Samantha Brinkman, and then NBC bought the pilot script, but did not ultimately make the pilot. So this year, working with the same people I worked with on the NBC project, and we have sold to ABC a new pilot that's kind of a fictionalized version of me and a fantasy rendering of what would happen if I went back to the office 8 years later.
That would be interesting.
It's a soapy, yeah, it's kind of a soapy legal thriller with lots of palace intrigue in the DA's office and around the DA's office and love interests and, you know, and of course, lots of danger lurking everywhere as my character, who is called Maya, has to navigate her reentry into the DA's office with all that entails. So, yeah, think of a soapy legal thriller. That's what we're looking for here. That's what we're doing here.
And does Maya, like I have a feeling Marcia Clark, have sympathy sometimes for those who are behind the bars?
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course. Maya knows that, you know, not all people who have been busted for crimes are terrible people. Some just make mistakes. So yeah, she's got a balanced view of things.
Yeah. So, Marcia, this is a happy time in your life.
Yeah, it really is. I'm getting to do a whole lot of things that I really love doing, and it's wonderful.
And your boys are doing great?
They're doing great, Joan. They're 27 and 25.
Oh,
they're,
my gosh.
They're people, yeah.
They were little boys when we met you first.
They were tiny. They were like 2.5 and 5 during the trial. So
I know. And that's a whole other story, because that's the hardest thing in the world. We are meant to feel guilty as women, because no matter what we do, we're not doing it right.
Exactly. You can't win.
You can't win, and especially when you're in a trial like that. As heady as it is, it's fraught with danger at every turn.
It's true. But I think it's interesting. I mean, look, men do big jobs too, but
always.
Nobody ever asks them, how do you balance it? I mean, you do balance it. You find a way to make the time to do both. And that's in today's world, more and more, everyone has to figure this out.
Right. You know what, Marcia, I always said, even to my kids, if they would complain, and they did, I'm doing the best I can do. And that's all we can do.
Right.
You know, no one has it perfectly. There is no real, the balance word is just a word. I wish we could all balance it. Even if you don't have kids, you can't balance your life.
True. But, you know, as Roseanne said during that sitcom, if at the end of the night the kids are still in bed and they're still breathing, I did good.
That's good. Exactly right. My mom always used to say, you have to survive your kids. You know, the Brady Bunch is on television, not in the real world. Anyway, I'm excited for you, and I'm glad that all these good things are happening.
Thank you so much, Joan. I so appreciate that.
And it's a really good read. And first of all, Marcia knows. I mean, this is her world. So it isn't like fantasy land. They're real flesh and blood people. Snap Judgment, the latest. and you want to find out what's going on with Samantha, because believe me, her life, if you think you have aggravation, go follow this woman. Where dinner is more often than not a McDonald's.
She's not big on the cooking.
No, or she's not big on the hot restaurants. Just put the food down and go on.
Exactly.
All right, Marcia, continued success. Love talking
to you,
and we'll talk soon.
Always a pleasure, Joan. Thank you so much.
Anytime. I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC.
New York culture with real New Yorkers. Joan Hamburg, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
You know, Fashion Week is here in our great town, and it has a lot of implications, not only in terms of fashion, but in terms of New York's economy. And there wouldn't be a Fashion Week if it wasn't for Fern Malice, who started it, who created this amazing event, which is not only here, but it's almost all over the world now. So Fern is a consultant in the fashion industry these days, and she also has a fabulous series at the 92nd Street Y called Fashion Icons. In fact, on September 11th, NBA star Russell Westbrook is going to be her guest. But I always turn to Fern to find out what's going on. Are the runway shows still as relevant as they were? Fashion Week, a lot of designers decided in the past they wanted to do their own thing. So here we are in the fall of 2017. What's the mood, dear Fern? Is everyone into it?
Hi, Joan. How are you?
I'm good, and I hope you are.
Oh, thank you. I am. And thank you for that lovely introduction. You know, there would have been fashion shows in New York with or without me, but, you know, what I'm proud of is having organized them for 20 years in Bryant Park, and where it was very
They were the best.
And now what's going on, fashion shows are absolutely still relevant, but they're no longer any really centralized initiatives. IMG still has one venue downtown, which has quite a lot of shows, but the shows are everywhere. I mean, they are just, and people are just a little bit crazed because traffic, as we know, in New York, is a nightmare. And just getting around and getting from one show to the next show, every hour on the hour for, you know, 6 days is kind of crazy.
Yeah, I never
so
understood.
That's making people nuts.
Yeah.
You know, but the shows are relevant. The designers are stepping up their game. You know, business hasn't been spectacular, so I think there's a lot riding on this season on a lot of people's collections. But it was kind of kicked off last night by
Tom Ford. How was it?
It was beautiful. He took over the Armory up here on Park Avenue, and it was very pink when you came in with these scrims, which opened after the show for a party where you felt like, you felt like it was the 90s back
right.
in the disco days, and, you know, all the waiters and bartenders, everybody, all gorgeous boys, all in shorts, bare-chested, you know, so it was...
Wow, sounds very good to me.
Yeah, it was very, lots of fun. But the collection was, you know, was kind of like Tom Ford is back. You know, really sexy, beautiful clothes, sexy shoes. Oh, my God, these stilettos on every girl that were kind of a satin of the color that they were wearing with a little like fringe detail around the yoke. I mean they all looked incredible. The clothes, lots of beautiful colors, you know, black and white, but pink and blue and yellows and but sexy, really sexy. Kind of the clothes you expect from, you want to see from Tom Ford.
Right. Well, I'm excited to hear that. The thing that I wanted to ask you, and I'm talking to Fern Malice, who actually created Fashion Week and now is one of the major consultants in the fashion industry, plus does a great series at the 92nd Street Y called Fashion Icons. As we know, retail is having its problems. So what is the impact of that on a designer like Time Ford or any of the designers, including the young ones who are coming right out of school, who's buying this stuff?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. But, you know, Tom's business is rather remarkable. I mean, he does an enormous men's business. And, I mean, there was just an article in this industry newsletter, Business of Fashion, about him being positioned to be, you know, well over, you know, close to a $2 billion business
in another year
or so. You know, and his cosmetics and fragrance are...
Eyeglasses,
sunglasses are through the roof.
Talking to Fern Malice. So if you were giving a lecture and you were saying, look, the industry is changing like every industry, but there are still major names that matter, like Tom Ford is back in front. Who else really matters?
Well, there's a lot of people that matter. You know, yesterday was also a luncheon that FIT's Couture Council hosts every year and honors somebody. And yesterday it was Tom Brown, who is one of the more influential designers out of America ever, mostly in menswear, but now in womenswear as well. He's part of what people are concerned about, because he's not going to show in New York this week. He's
going
to have his show in Paris. And he said there's more new business for him to acquire in Paris, and it's better for his business. And the young designers, Parenza School, are showing in Paris, and Rodarte is showing in Paris, and Joseph Altuzarra, who's one of our bright talents here, although he is French by, you know, birth. He's half French, so he wants to show this year in Paris. So that put everybody in a tizzy a few months ago when the schedules were coming out.
So Fern, you think that New York has lost its identity with the scatteredness of Fashion Week?
No, I don't really. No, I won't say that. I won't go there. I think. Mm-hmm. You know, I will say that for every one of those who left, there's some new designers
coming
stepping
up
into the plate in taking in those time slots. You know, I mean, we still have, you know, the Calvin Klein show here with Raf Simons, who
is back, right?
There. And Raf Simons has totally re-energized that house of Calvin Klein. And they are doing a lot of good retail and selling. You know, I think the answer to your question earlier about retail, lots of these designers doing their own stores to try and at least get their message out loud and clear to their customers. But it's all about online and having their own e-commerce businesses or working with, you know, the Farfetch's and the Net-a-Porter and all of the different online e-commerce sites that aggregate many, many different designers. I mean, that's really where the business is happening.
You know what? But
online.
I'm curious. If it's one thing if you're buying like Old Navy, you know, or something that's sort of basic and very well priced, inexpensive. But if you're buying high end couture, even the shoes you're talking about, an online business?
I kind of agree with you a little bit, but apparently the answer is yes, they're doing it. And those customers know their sizes, they know their shoes, and you know who's making a lot of money? UPS.
Exactly.
FedEx, and everybody sending things and sending them back if they don't work. You know, also part of this week, overlapping with Fashion Week, I'm involved with a conference called CurvyCon, which is a two-day conference for the plus size market.
You know what? I was going to ask you about that. And you're moderating something, right, with my old friend Emmy.
Yes, yes. Emmy's going to be on the panel. And
Large-size fashion model in her time.
Yes, and Stacey London and my friends who are from Dia & Co., who are sponsoring that conference. And they have a great plus-size business. It's all online. You know, it's a subscription business. There's over 1 million subscribers. And
that's interesting.
You know, you get a box every month of 5 pieces. And if you don't like something, you send it back.
Plus-size was always, you know, needed more designers to come to rescue there.
It is money sitting on the table in this industry that designers have ignored for too long.
Yeah.
And now it is finally getting its recognition. And, you know, Christian Siriano has done an amazing job with it. Michael Kors has plus-size models in there. Prabal Gurung, Tracy Reese, all these designers are now including a diverse group of models on their runways showing all those sizes. So the CurvyCon conference should be a busy one.
I bet.
You know, and I'm looking forward to seeing what's happening in that universe. But there's lots of fun things going on, and there's lots of new good shows. The Brock Collection is a young couple who are doing beautiful work.
Mm-hmm.
Rosie Asseline, who I adore, doing beautiful work. Alexander Wang's doing a show in Brooklyn, I think, in Bushwick.
That's interesting. But let me ask you, has pop culture, stars like Rihanna, people like that, do they have a real influence in the industry?
They have an influence. I don't know that they're changing
the landscape
significant
there.
In the landscape of the industry, mm-hmm. but Rihanna's doing a show for her Fenty Puma collection. You know, and it's going to be interesting because, I mean, like you mentioned, my talk with Russell Westbrook.
Yeah, I just said that. I said, like, he's designing now.
Well, he's done a lot of designer collaborations a little while ago that Barney's had with about 10 different brands, and everything sold out. He's just has a book coming out now, and I was told last night that the minute he tweeted about the book, it went immediately to number one on the Amazon fashion book list.
And it's out already?
It's just out now. Yes, we're going to have it at the Y, signed copies by him. But he's one of the athletes who are moving the baton a little bit, because these athletes now have huge followings and they're real fashion.
And they can sell.
And they sell, and they move the needle. So that's going to be interesting, talking to him about that.
Right, and I think the whole menswear thing is interesting. You talked about it years ago. It's a true renaissance.
The menswear market is very, very exciting, absolutely. And CFDA is now organizes once again an organized men's week in the summer and in the winter, and it's been very well attended. Everybody's been very happy with it, and lots of good designers showing.
Right.
So, I mean, I think it's a busy week. I think one of the things that, honestly, that I've been looking forward to about this week is not spending my day sitting working in my office with, MSNBC on behind me and listening to what's going
right.
on in this country.
To get away from it. I know we have to.
I know you have to. You're there in the news business on the radio. But, it's like please a respite for a few days, and
I love it.
And just praying for everybody on these hurricanes, which is
it's really horrible.
So horrifying. And that's not going to help retail, let me tell you.
Not at all.
I'm due to go to Neiman Marcus in another week and a half for an event in Houston, and I'm waiting for confirmation that that's still going ahead.
Yeah.
But, that's knocking out billions of dollars of business.
Yeah. That's right. And it's
in the South, and then the whole Florida and the East Coast is, going
on alert.
Charlotte and, Charleston and Savannah and everywhere. I mean, all that's going to affect, are you going to run out and go buy clothing when you have to rebuild your house?
Exactly.
I don't think so.
And we were just talking earlier, Fern. I'm talking to Fern Malice, who created Fashion Week and is still the leading consultant in the fashion industry, that many of this devastation has occurred in places where they're not in flood zones. They never even had flood insurance. Uh-huh. So you're right. Economically, it's such a great disaster. Much more complicated than rebuilding homes, apartments. Its impact on business is huge.
Yeah.
But we are going to relish that New York's Fashion Week is through the 14th, and wonderful things to look at, great stories to hear, and we all need a welcome diversion. So thank you, Fern.
Lots of good people watching.
We can't wait. And we'll talk to you again before it's over. Fern Malice.
All right, thanks.
Take care of yourself. I'm Joan Hamburg for WABC.
New York culture with real New Yorkers. Joan Hamburg, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
The TV landscape is changing so fast that we actually need a guide. There are so many channels. there are so many alternatives. And yet, when I think about this summer, I don't really remember people talking about, you've got to see this. So I'm very interested in what Jen Chaney, who's a TV columnist for Vulture, that's New York Magazine's entertainment and culture news site. And Jen reviews all these TV shows, talks about what's going on in the world of TV. And certainly the news aspect of TV has been the benefit of Donald Trump. How many more panels can we see? Also, there are exciting shows. But Jed, from your point of view, is there something that I may have missed this summer, a big hit that everyone's talking about?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that there was not a big breakout new show that was a hit over the summer, you know, compared to, say, last summer when everybody was talking about Stranger Things on Netflix. And, right. and that was, you know, really dominated the culture over, you know, even a lot of the big movies that were coming out. You know, I think the show that everybody was talking about this summer, and it was no surprise at all, was Game of Thrones, because it happened to start airing at a slightly different time, and it ended right at the end of the summer, and that, but that was going to dominate the conversation no matter when it came out. There really wasn't one big, strong, you've got to see this show, like you said.
Right, and what happened with Twin Peaks, The Return?
Well, you know, I think for a certain subset of people, and I would count television and film critics like myself in that group, Twin Peaks The Return was the show of the summer. It started back in May, and it ended just a couple of days ago over the Labor Day weekend, so it really spanned the season. And it was experimental and like nothing else that you are seeing on television right now, in the same way that the original was like nothing else that, during its time. But it was so out there that it didn't necessarily capture a mainstream audience, the sort of the people who were watching it week to week right when it aired. It was a really small group. But for that group, it was a big deal. And I think that's reflective, actually, of the way that we watch television now, where there is, as you said, so many different things to watch that certain shows get a really strong fan base behind them that may not be reflective of the mass population.
Right.
But they really are super, super into what they're watching.
And, you know, I'm curious, you're in the business, but how do most people know that XYZ is on Netflix or wherever it is? Because you don't read that much, you know, in the beginning. And then all of a sudden, you know, you've got to watch Game of Thrones or something like that.
Well, I'll be honest, even for those of us who are in the business, it's hard to keep up, you know?
Yeah, there's so many channels.
There's so many channels, and especially with Netflix, for example, a lot of times they'll just suddenly announce something that you didn't even know was coming. So it's hard for even those of us who are well-versed in this to keep up with everything.
So from your perspective, if you have not seen some of these shows or the new ones that are coming up, what should we look for and see? People binge on this stuff.
Right. And I think, you know, as I look at what's coming this fall, I'm actually more excited about some of the things that are returning shows that are coming back
like,
than I am about some of the brand new things. Well, a show that just started last night that I think is going to be very provocative and get people talking is the new season of American Horror Story. It's called American Horror Story Cult. It's not going to be to everyone's taste, that's for sure. It is very, it's violent and it's extreme, but it's predicated in a lot of ways on the presidential election last year and the trauma that has caused for different people. And I find it really, really interesting, and it was definitely being talked about a lot on Twitter last night during the premiere. And that's a limited series. So the thing about shows like that is that even if you haven't seen any of the previous seasons, it really doesn't matter. You can pick up where this starts and go forward from there, because it's a different story every time.
Mm-hmm. And you have to watch everything, but TV Land, are they doing anything exciting? They're doing Younger, right?
They are, and I love Younger. I think it's really, really great. And that's another good example of a show that, you know, I don't think its viewership is necessarily massive, but it does have an audience. I think it's the highest performer that TV Land has, and it's something that people do talk about on social media every week. And I like it because it's a smart show. but it's also light, which I think people really need very much
exactly.
right now.
Exactly. It's got Sutton Foster, too.
And Sutton Foster is wonderful. I mean, the premise for those who aren't familiar is that Sutton Foster plays a woman who's in her early 40s, but she has to pretend that she's in her 20s in order to get a job in the publishing industry, which is a sort of a silly premise, but they make it work, and they keep finding ways to continue that tension of whether or not she's going to be completely found out and what will happen if she is. But it's also this wonderful fantasy land version of New York that is just really fun to live in for a half hour every week.
Exactly. So all these channels, Netflix is still running hot?
I mean, they keep, you know, they have started to pare back a little bit and actually cancel some shows that I think maybe a year or two ago they would have kept going with. So, for example, one of the shows they put on this summer was called Gypsy with Naomi Watts. Given the caliber of people involved in it, you would have thought, well, that's going to run on Netflix for a long time. But the first season was not good, and they canceled it right away. That being said, it's like for every show they cancel, I feel like there's another or maybe two or three new ones that they're putting on. So there's still a lot to keep track of as far as Netflix is concerned. And certainly the big thing coming from them this upcoming season is the second season of Stranger Things, which will debut in October.
Yeah.
And I think will be something everybody's talking about, given how popular the first season was.
And is there anything that you're watching on regular traditional channels, 2, 4, 7?
The old-fashioned networks.
The old-fashioned networks. You know, when my kid was, one of them was very young, I'd say, well, what do you want for the holidays? And he would say, oh, I want Channel 4 and Channel 2 because of all the constant advertising. And they had no competition in those days.
Right. Yeah. No, I remember that's how I grew up watching TV. It was ABC, NBC, CBS.
Right.
That was it. And maybe something fuzzy you could get by, you know, messing with the rabbit ears a little bit. but yeah, I mean, there is good stuff on network television. A show that I really love that is coming back later this month on NBC is The Good Place.
Wait, what is it? What did you just say?
It's called The Good Place.
The Good Place.
Yes. It's with Kristen Bell and Ted Danson.
Uh-huh.
And the premise is that Kristen Bell's character ends up in the afterlife and sort of a version of heaven. But she was a very bad person when she was on Earth. And so there's clearly been some sort of mistake. And the whole thing is about, in the first season, her trying to sort of pull one over on everybody and remain in this wonderful heavenly place. But then she also starts to realize that maybe this place isn't exactly what she thinks it is either, but it's a comedy, so it's really funny, but they do a wonderful job of world building, and then the finale sort of twisted everything so that you had a completely different understanding of what's going on. So I really look forward to seeing what they do in season two.
Okay, I'm talking to Jen Chaney, who's TV columnist for Vulture, that's New York Magazine's entertainment and cultural news site. So talk to me about panel show, panel show, panel show, MSNBC, CNN, you name it. We're like glassy-eyed. We're so, like, in my house, Trumped out already.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting. I mean, certainly as you are suggesting, the cable news has benefited from a bump because people are
watching.
Very interested. Yeah, they're very interested in the news. MSNBC is doing extremely well. Right now, I think for that reason.
And I think they have good talent, don't you?
I mean, I do.
The reporters are smart and young and attractive and out there.
Yeah, no, I definitely do. They're probably who I go to first when I am going to turn on cable news. I guess it's appropriate given that we've elected our first reality show president, but there is a sense that, you know, television is competing with this, the craziness that's going on in our actual world for our attention. And as I was alluding to before, it's even seeping into what we watch as entertainment, not only with things like American Horror Story, but, you know, John Oliver, all of the late night shows, Seth Meyers, Stephen Colbert. I mean,
are you a fan?
I am. I think Seth Meyers in particular is doing really strong stuff. Yeah. And I think, you know, the thing about those shows is that it's at this point less about whether you're actually up at 12:30 in the morning watching Seth Meyers in real time versus am I watching the clips of Seth Meyers in the morning when I get up, and are they being passed around online? And I see that happening more and more.
Absolutely. And, you know, some of the problem, I mean, on CBS, The Late Show was interesting because he was one of the first to go after Trump full time, and it gave him an audience. But every now and then I'm like, hey, stop, get over it a little bit, give us a breath. And
yeah,
because it's almost too much goodness, eating too many brownies. We got to stop.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I wish that the old Colbert show was still on, because I think that would be even more fascinating to watch him grappling with this in that context. But I do like what Colbert is doing in general.
No, he was the first one to get it, and it was important.
Right.
Well, we all look forward to a new season, and I look forward to talking to you again. Jen Chaney, TV columnist for Vulture, which is New York Magazine's big entertainment and cultural news site. All the best to you. We'll talk.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC.
Your New York weekend is not complete without the Joan Hamburg Show on 77 WABC.
Hour two of the Joan Hamburg Show. I know, Saturday, we are leaving you at 3 o'clock. Maybe going to curl up with Chris Kimball, whom you met. I think you met him before, but he was he's going to be one of our guests this hour. Curl up with his new cookbook, the new Milk Street, New Home Cooking. And this is a new venture for this whole family. So that should be a lot of fun. We've got great guests lined up for you. I know you're going to enjoy it. My pal Ben Brantley from the New York Times is going to give you the latest on what theater tickets to get. The city is alive with the promise of all the good things to come. And we've got to sort of take our heads off politics and enjoy ourselves and think. And we also have to reach out and help all of those hurt so terribly from all these storms and hurricanes. So a lot going on in the world. And I'm always happy to have you join me. And by the way, if you can't listen to the whole show, don't worry about it. You can go right to the podcast, WABCradio.com, The Joan Hamburg Show. We're available on Facebook. We're available on Twitter. And don't forget, you can always message me your questions. We respond to everything. So settle back, enjoy hour two, because lots coming up straight ahead. This is WABC.
From food to fun and so much more, The Joan Hamburg Show, exclusively on 77 WABC.
All right, everyone, welcome to the Joan Hamburg Show. And you've met Chris Kimball before with me, one of the great food people. And Chris has something fairly new. It's called Milk Street, and it's a terrific magazine with amazing recipes and stories. He's got a new TV show, which is either launched or launching, and we're going to tell you all about that. In fact, Chris sort of does it all. He films for television, he does radio, he teaches at his cooking school, and his concept is predicated on dealing with food and recipes that will change how you cook and look at food forever. And Chris shares his own experiences. He grew up in New England, and it was travel, wasn't it, Chris, that first changed your head and changed your taste buds?
Yeah, I 1963, I went to Mexico with my family, parents and sister, and I had cilantro for the first time, and I hated it. But
an acquired taste.
Well, it was such a foreign taste. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I remember most about that trip is that. And then I started traveling as I grew older. And, there are just a lot of different ways of thinking about putting dinner on the table. It's very, very different than Northern Europe. And that really has started to change entirely. Not just how I cook, but how I think about cooking.
Right. And you described, which I think I just read in this issue of the magazine, driving. You were in Vietnam and you were driving from the airport into Hanoi, and having been to Vietnam a couple of times, that picture in my head of there you are, there are so many motorbikes you can barely move. There are people driving with live animals on their back.
Yeah, there are. They had, one guy had four piglets in a milk crate on the back. Somebody else had, you know, 15-foot long pieces of wood balanced on a shoulder. I've seen families of five or six people on one bike. There's still rice paddies, you know, between the airport and Hanoi. And of course, when you get into Hanoi, it's unlike Saigon. It's a really interesting mix of people, food. It's very, very, very different than any other place I've ever been to.
Yeah, and it's very hard to cross the street.
And it's very hard. Well, actually, Saigon is the worst.
It's worse.
There literally are a million motorbikes in Saigon, and I think they must lose a couple hundred people every day because it's a, the intersections are a game of Russian roulette. You know, it's chicken, so it's quite something. But I have to say that the flavors, you know, lemongrass with steamed clams, for example, you know, those little things you remember, and those, my point in that piece in the article in the magazine was, the things you remember from the travel are tastes, you know, really. Those are the things that stick with you more than anything else.
Well, and you know, I remember, and I've been lucky enough to travel a lot, that first time in Vietnam, in Saigon, eating a bowl of broth and noodles, and I thought, oh, you know, what could this be? And it was so shocking when it hit my tongue that it's extraordinary. You know, you're not going to go buy those old packaged noodles so fast when you get home.
Well, the thing that I finally realized, I was late to the party, but that people, not only do people use ingredients differently, fermented sauces, chilies, handfuls of herbs, tons of spices, but they think about cooking differently. There's, you know, sweet goes with savory. You know, sweet goes with hot. There's contrast. Northern European cooking is really about taking fairly bland ingredients, very few spices. You know, French cooking is a sprig of time, right? And a lot of technique and a lot of time and a lot of heat to come up with something that's really very good. But that's not how most people in the world cook. They start with big flavors, right? And and the cooking is actually fairly short. It's not about the cooking. It's about the prep. It's about what you're starting with. And I think in the 21st century, that gets you to a much better place, much faster and more easily than the classic French cooking, which, you know, to be honest, is really an acquired technique over many years. Whereas if you're in Chiang Mai, Thailand, and you do a stir-fried rice, or you do a simple soup, it's relatively easy to do because you're starting with really big flavors at the outset.
And, you know, this year, and I have a couple of things I want to ask you. We were talking about France, and it reminded me of the recipe in your new issue of this magazine of that French pie that was not only easy to do, but sounded so delicious. I can't wait to make it.
The French apple cake?
Yeah, the French apple cake.
That was, for people who haven't made it, you don't have to make a crust.
I loved that.
It usually has diced apples, raw apples. It's a little custardy inside. We changed it up a little. We pre-cooked the sliced apples for about 10 minutes in a skillet to caramelize them. But it's almost a dump and stir recipe. I just made it a couple of weeks ago. It's not hard to make, but you have much more flavor than, although I love apple pie, it's one of my favorite things.
Yeah,
It's a richer flavor, and it's easier to do because you don't have to roll a pie crust.
No, I loved it. But what a year you've had. You've got a public TV show, a magazine, a cooking school, and you're traveling everywhere.
I'm traveling. Our cookbook comes out from Little Brown next month. It's been quite a year. I'm getting too old for this, you know?
No, you're never too old. Are you having fun?
I'm having more fun than I've ever had. We have a great group of people. There's about 25 people here in Boston. We're on Milk Street in Boston.
That's perfect.
Why we call it Milk Street. It's in an old 1890 wonderful building. And, yeah, you know, it's fun because I really have changed the way I cook in the last few years. And when you bring people into the cooking school or they get the magazine, you can see their eyes light up. You know, they realize, oh, this is a very different way of thinking about food, and it's more fun. It's bigger flavors. It's, you know, classic American food, Northern European food, is very subtle, right? I mean, really, and some of it's terrific, but it's not, they're not big contrasts. A great dish you put in your mouth, as you were talking earlier, and lots of things are going on, right? I mean, you can take the fifth bite and you still discover something new, mm-hmm. and that's really the complexity to the ingredients, not in terms of technique, but in terms of how they work together. You know, in the Middle East, they'll use sumac, for example, and they'll put 2 or 3 tablespoons of it on a chicken dish, and it's this wild, crazy flavor, and it's just really exciting.
Mm. I'm talking to Chris Kimball, and Milk Street is his new baby and his TV show. American Public Television is doing it. He's got a new cookbook coming out, a beautiful magazine, which you're all going to have a ball, even if you don't feel like cooking, just reading all these stories. And they give you so much side stuff that you really feel like you're on the journey with Chris and his crew. And whether you've never used sumac, there are a lot of ingredients I have not used before, but they're doable, and that's part of the joy of cooking. So the TV show will be wherever your local public television is, right? And are you starting right after Labor Day?
Yeah, September 9th is the first day. Where it should be in about 90% of the country by the end of September. Just about every market will carry it, and we'll actually on our website, you can there'll be a directory of stations, but or you can ask your local station.
So, and yeah, what are you going to do on it?
Well, it's a little different than what I've done before. We tend to start somewhere else in the world, like Thailand, and we'll go spend time there and eat the food, and then we say, okay, well, this inspired us to come back to Milk Street to take that idea and then put it into terms that work here.
Mm-hmm.
We're not reproducing authentic recipes from around the world. We're being inspired by them and then figuring out how to adapt them here. I mean, we don't want to use a lot of ingredients you can't find or cookware that you don't have, so we have to adapt. And then we bring them back to the kitchen, and we have a live audience for part of the show, and we cook the food. But we're always inspired by something we found in, you know, Cape Town, South Africa, something that happened in Tunisia, something that happened in Peru, and bring it back here and then make a recipe that's actually quite doable for the American audience.
Mm. Do you eat a lot? How do you deal with all this food? How does your wife deal with it?
Well, you know, because you've been in this a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, the secret is you have to figure out how to take a bite.
Well, that's
tasting.
See, and that's always been a big issue. Because if it's really good, it's hard, right?
Well, that French apple cake, I admit, on a few occasions, I ate the whole piece, which was not ideal if you have a bunch of other tastings. But you try to take a bite or two and put down your fork, because otherwise, you know, everyone's going to be much bigger a year from now the way we with the amount of stuff we're testing.
Right. Well, I love the way there are so many different cultures that are involved in Milk Street. I mean, it's the face of America now, even though you're taking us to exotic ports.
I think that we've ended a phase. We've ended this phase of the sort of National Geographic phase where people go to another country and you try to authentically reproduce what's there. I think, like fashion and music, we're entering a phase where it's more of a mashup, where you're inspired. You know, people in Istanbul don't just cook Turkish food, and people in Mexico City, you know, they'll make a pesto.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, everybody isn't just cooking their own food anymore. And so the idea of home cooks sharing all of this and coming up with a lot of shared technique and ingredients. I mean, I flew to Washington yesterday, came back, and, you know, there was a Lebanese fast food joint at the airport in Washington. You know, you could get stuffed grape leaves, and you can get hummus, and you can get tabbouleh that's almost all parsley. And so all of this stuff is, because of the media and restaurants and TV and your show, people are much more sophisticated about Mexican cooking. You know, it's not just burritos. People understand what it's about. And so that's what's going to happen in the next 5 years, is everyone's going to try a little bit of everything. And it's not going to be this cuisine versus that cuisine. It's going to be a combination.
Right. And that's what it's all about. Well, all the best to you, Chris. I can't wait for the new cookbook, for the new TV show, for all the 2 zillion things you do before breakfast. And are any of your kids involved in food?
Well, one of my kids, I have 5 kids, my second oldest daughter.
Wait, did your baby come already?
Yes, I now have a 3.5-month-old son, Oliver James.
Oh, so, God bless. Fantastic.
My mother, many, many years ago, said it was time to hang up the gloves. The baby part,
but well, you know what? Five is plenty.
You know what? I'm a little older, and I appreciate having a young child much more than I ever did. I think it takes a little time to understand what a blessing it is. So yeah,
right.
We're thrilled.
Well, it is a blessing, and we wish you and your family all the best. We'll talk really soon.
Thanks, Joan.
Congratulations. I'm Joan Hamburg with Chris Kimball, Milk Street. You can get the magazine. You can watch the TV show. The cookbook will be out soon. He's also on the radio, but we never like to promote other radio shows. But this guy is really good. I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC.
Backstage with Broadway's Best. Behind the Curtain with Joan Hamburg on 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
Well, I love this time of year. All the fields out on the east end of Long Island are filled with pumpkins, which means new seasons. And what's better than even anticipating theater? Ben Brantley, the chief theater critic for the New York Times, who also takes us to London, lucky Ben, is going to give us a little preview of what's happening. Now, two things opened recently. Prince of Broadway, and that's about Hal Prince, one of the great producers, directors, everything. He's been creating some of the best theater that you can imagine. And then Michael Moore is on Broadway in The Terms of My Surrender. But lots of things are coming in. Welcome to you, Ben Brantley.
Thank you very much. It's an interesting season ahead, Joan. It's not the obvious blockbuster star name kind of lineup that we often have this time of year, but it's really intriguing. I mean, you could even say it's exotic, for at least on Broadway terms, what's coming. I'm especially excited about the transfer of The Band's Visit, a new musical based on an Arab-Israeli film from the 1990s that I saw at the Atlantic Theater Company that is just enchanting. I've never seen a musical that's quite that subtle and evocative, and it's a strange little airy romance, and I'm really looking forward to seeing that on Broadway.
Well, and for you to sound so excited is, we all ran out to get tickets for that. But let me ask you, what's the story with coming into the Vivian Beaumont junk?
I'm sorry, what?
Into the Beaumont.
What's the story? Well, I think it's going to be an intriguing play, don't you? It's, but is that definitely happening? I didn't realize that.
I get, as we all do, all the stuff from the press agents and from the theatrical index. So who knows? But
right. It's Ayad Akhtar who is and Doug Hughes, which it, should be a winning combination. And it's about a man named Robert Merkin, who was an investment banker who took on American capitalism and supposedly changed the rules. The other really exciting element about that is that Stephen Pasquale, Broadway's
I love him.
Favorite. Well, of course you would. Every woman I know does, and a lot of men. Broadway's favorite heartthrob at the moment, who is in Bridges of Madison County, and a fine actor, and hasn't really had a chance to show his dramatic chops. So I'm looking forward to him in this.
And of course, M. Butterfly.
Well,
which
that
we've
should be very intriguing, shouldn't
back.
It? I mean,
yes.
The fact that it's Julie Taymor back on Broadway for the first time since the debacle of Spider-Man,
right.
But who proves she certainly still has her creative inventiveness and stage chops with a production of Midsummer Night's Dream in Brooklyn at Theater for a new audience a few years ago. So it'll be fascinating to see how she uses her particular puppet-driven stage wiles to reimagine this rather classic play. And it's got Clive Owen, the British actor who was
right,
been on Broadway in old times. Yeah, an extraordinary presence. It'll be very interesting to see what he does with that.
And is Carousel still on target?
I believe it is. That could be... could be a fascinating production, but that's not until March.
Yeah.
So we sort of have to, we still have to dream a little about that one, but it's got Jesse Mueller, Joshua Henry, and Renee Fleming singing, I believe, you know, When You Walk Through a Storm. Who can, I mean, that's really deluxe to have Renee Fleming for that part.
Right, no, and as you say, there are so many interesting things coming in, maybe not everything now, you know, it's the end of September, October, November, but it's happening. What else are you looking forward to?
Well, don't forget we have Amy Schumer making her Broadway debut in Steve Martin's play Meteor Showers and Laura Benanti, another fine actress, is going to be in that as well. But, you know, Amy Schumer should pretty much guarantee good box office. And Elizabeth McGovern is coming to Broadway in a British play that I saw at the National Theater a few years ago that's not produced all that much, called Time in the Conways by J.B. Priest from the late 1930s, but it's about being able to, it's about existing in your past, present, and future simultaneously. So Ms. McGovern has her Doctor Who outfit on, surely, for this production. And we have Uma Thurman making her Broadway debut.
I know.
And The Paris Woman by Beau Willimon, about a Washington hostess. Not a great time to be a Washington hostess, I would
not
say.
At all. There is no place to host.
No. So anyway,
no one's coming to dinner.
We have What's on This Island, a revival coming in December. A charming musical by Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty that a lot of people feel has been overdue for a revival. And I know what you're looking forward to, Joan, is SpongeBob SquarePants.
I can't wait. Although I'll tell you, my granddaughter, Frozen, which... I mean, what? There isn't a child who isn't obsessed with that.
Oh, of course, yeah. No, that looks like it could well be, you know, the next Wicked in terms of getting that sort of tween audience. You can bet there'll be a lot of kids and people who are no longer kids in that audience singing along with Let It Go.
Right.
You know, every single lyric. Yeah. And we've got Mark Rylance, 2-time Tony winner, coming back to Broadway with Farinelli and the King, written by Claire Van Kampen, in which he plays the Spanish monarch with a bad case of insomnia who needs to hire a castrato to sing him to sleep. And what I'm really looking forward to also, Lucy Kirkwood has a play called The Children that I didn't get to see when it was at the Royal Court that people say is terrific. It's coming in the Royal Court production, same director, James McDonald, who's excellent. And thanks to the Manhattan Theater Club, we'll be showing up on Broadway.
They're doing great stuff. But it is interesting that a lot of movie stars, which producers generally try to lasso in to sell tickets, we're not seeing as many. We're seeing a lot of good actors.
No, I mean,
actors.
Clive Owen, I guess, you know, you wouldn't put in the same category as Tom Cruise, but he's certainly a known name. And Elizabeth McGovern has a lot of cachet right now because of Downton Abbey. You know, she played the American lady of the manor in that. No, the biggest name as far as, you know, marquee names go would be Amy Schumer. And we have Bernadette taking over, Bernadette Peters taking over from Bette Midler early next year.
I know, I was going to ask you, what do you think?
Oh, she, I mean,
we
I
love her.
Bernadette is someone I'd see in anything. She's one of the true originals in American performance. And I think she'll make the part her own.
Me too. I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, me too.
And I hope everyone takes advantage of seeing Bernadette. And she's got a new guy, too, in the play.
Oh, she does indeed. Victor Garber, who, you know, should be perfect. I mean, I've never seen Victor Garber bad. And he's, I believe the first time I saw him was many, many years ago in the original Sweeney Todd, in which he played the sailor who sings Joanna.
Right.
Opposite, it was Angela Lansbury and Lynn Cario in that. One of the most memorable productions I ever saw.
And that's Ben Brantley, chief theater critic of the New York Times, with a really exciting list of theater that everyone should avail themselves and get tickets now, because every one of these shows has something wonderful about it. The magic of a new season. I'll talk to you soon, Ben Brantley.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Joan Hamburg. You're listening to WABC.
New York culture with real New Yorkers. Joan Hamburg, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
You know, we have been talking a lot recently about teens and young 20s. We've been talking about the impact of digital social media, what it's doing to this group of kids. And Kate Fagan, who's a columnist and feature writer for ESPNW, ESPN.com, and ESPN the magazine. Kate, who covered the 76ers for the Philadelphia Inquirer, has written a heartbreaking but fascinating book, What Made Maddie Run, subtitled The Secret Struggles and Tragic Death of an All-American Teen. And this is something else. You add sports and sports in college, and you put this on top of all the connection that kids have today online, not so much in person. And then you take these kids and send them off to these schools, and they have an expectation that isn't exactly what happens. So, Kate, welcome. An amazing job with this book, heartbreaking as it is. And how did this get into your life?
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. And yeah, the origin story is simply that I, like many people, saw the headlines in the days after Madison's death. And I just, there were so many points of her story that I felt connected to. I had lived in Philly, as you mentioned, and she had gone to the University of Pennsylvania. My sister was a runner at an Ivy League school, and I had theories about perfectionism and the pursuit, the isolated pursuit that runners often engage in. And then I myself had played basketball at the University of Colorado and really struggled during my freshman year, had tried to quit. And so as soon as I saw these headlines about Madison, I wanted to know more, and I thought it could be possible that Madison's story was very emblematic of young people today, and some of her struggles, I think, are ones that a lot of high school and college age kids can relate to.
Right. And Madison, a kid who you would look at and say, this child, this 19-year-old, has literally everything, from her terrific family, her friends, her intellect, her great looks, her Ivy League acceptance, one of the best schools in the country. And yet her world fell apart and she ended up committing suicide. So how does this happen? How does a kid who seems so balanced and so goal-oriented, how does this kid suddenly fall apart to that extent?
Yeah. Well, I think the most important point is that, like, there's no one thing. There's no one moment. There's no, like, this is the why. But there are a lot of factors surrounding it, and we try to investigate those in the book. And so when it comes to Madison, one of them was the simple fact of the transition to college, that she had succeeded and by all accounts was, like, even by her own accounts and a lot of her own writing, like, happy go lucky kid through high school. And then that transition to college for a lot of young people can be the first big transition that might trigger anxiety or depression. And it might be something that is hidden and lurking, and then that transition can set it off. And that was certainly the case with Madison. And then there was just the loss of identity that I think a lot of kids go through when they transition to, if they're lucky enough, you know, to go to a college. Is in high school, you identify and you build up your identity through whatever, whether it's academics, athletic, a combination of both, and maybe you're great at those things and you're seen in that community as Maddie was, as a success story. And you get to college and you're surrounded with a lot of people who were also the success stories in high school, right. And it can really shift your identity when you know, winning the race is no longer the goal. It's, you know, in the middle of the pack as you start to understand the competition level. And a lot of these things can really trigger a lot of identity issues within young people.
And yet here was a youngster who, like a lot of kids, it's hard to really talk about what she's going through, even though kids talk all the time on social media. But it was interesting, and I think you pointed it out so well, they sort of edit what they're really thinking on social media to deal with it in a way that really isn't real. But so you're saying here's a youngster that obviously during those growing up years did not have mental illness, or maybe she had all these deep doubts, which is not uncommon among adolescent girls, that was couched in other terms.
Yeah, and the social media aspect and the way Madison was presenting those first few months at the University of Pennsylvania is important, because I think to the outside world and to her friends who weren't the closest with her, everything looked like the ideal college experience. I mean, Madison's Instagram feed is still online, and you can look at it and you can see that it seems to represent everything we tell kids their college experience is going to be like. But clearly, as she articulated to her mom, you know, those are just pictures. Like, you know, when her mom asked her, well, you seem happy at this party, Madison's like, well, that's just a picture. So there was an understanding that she herself was editing her online life, though there was not as easy an understanding that other people were doing the same thing. And then when you add on top of it just the volume of digital communication, like text messages, that Madison was using to explain her struggles. And then when you also look at the studies that show that, like, text messaging does not elicit the same, you know, human reaction in terms of, like, compassion and empathy, like the actual chemicals released in your body. And so the takeaway there for me was, like, don't assume that, one, because someone's social feed looks good, and also maybe their communication to you digitally seems, you know, like they're struggling, but there's emojis. Like, you just never, I was baffled when I looked at her computer and iMessages. I thought I was going to get this rich revelation. And really it was more of just the day to day, like, I'm not happy. And I think it really shows how hard it is to really understand what someone's going through in our technological age.
And what we're talking about, Kate Fagan's brand new book, What Made Maddie Run. And it's about this very talented student athlete, a 19-year-old girl, a great family, a great community, a lot of friends. This is a kid that you would say, boy, they did a great job on this child, and gets in to her dream school, the University of Penn, and her life starts falling apart. It's college athletics, which really in some cases give you a feeling of belonging, but in other cases take you away from what people would say is a real college life. And couple that with social media and with depression, a form of mental illness that this kid never really dealt with before. And you've got what happened to her. She ended up taking her own life, which to this day is a shock in not only the Penn community, but in her growing up community and her family, her siblings.
Yeah, and I think the point you make about college athletics is important, because it's not just college athletics. I think some of the culture within even youth sports and high school sports really is about, like, pushing through and getting, you know, and building the perfect resume. And a lot of times kids don't know whether they love a sport or whether they love the cultural rewards that athletics have in our culture. And within, I know, and then if I take it to the college athletic department, specifically with Maddie, there's just not enough athletic departments right now that have the resources and the staffing to address mental health issues among their athletes. I mean, the numbers are just really low about what schools employ full-time professionals. So I think just having kids and parents be aware, one, that the transition can be difficult, and then two, that the sport that you think you love, when you get to college and it becomes a job, can really be a cause for anxiety, and that you need to be prepared how you're going to deal with that if you are one of the athletes who deals with that, because there is not the infrastructure right now at the college level to handle that the way parents might hope it would be handled. It's going to be something you guys are going to have a conversation about.
You know, it would be interesting if they ever could statistically figure out, do the students who get into, well, no matter what college, but into a Penn and are not recruited for teams, do they do better in terms of their expectation? Because most of them in these schools are stars in their own school, whether it's on the track field or in a classroom.
Yeah, and I mean, I think when you look at the studies that show anxiety and depression among college kids, the rates are rising in both student-athlete populations and the general population, but they are higher in the general population. And they've always historically been higher, although both are rising. I think, to me, it's fascinating to figure out why, because these are all humans produced, you know, in our same U.S. culture. But it, to me, the simple answer to that could be that athletes are probably less likely to say out loud that they might be struggling with anxiety and depression because of the culture of college sports and athletic departments being, you know, one of, like, a pursuit of, you know, excellence and bigger, faster, stronger. But it's important to point out that the rates of anxiety and depression in the general population are rising and are higher than the athletic department. And so it is something
interesting.
Now trying to look at the cultural issues of how we raise our kids, like you mentioned on the outset, technology, social media, how that's affecting their brains, a lot of different factors at play here.
Well, and you do talk a lot about the digital aspect of all this and how these kids spend their lives on it, even describing her ride back to college with her dad. Constantly glued to her phone. So it's a kind of connectiveness which really isn't real.
Yeah, it's basically Alone Together, I think was the name of a book explaining that phenomenon. And, you know, for Madison, the effect of social media seemed to be that the consumption of other people's social media, whether it was people at Penn who were living a college experience that she thought she was going to have but wasn't having, or looking at her friends' social media off at other colleges, seeming to have the great college experience, the absorption of all of that exacerbated her anxiety and depression. And I think if you look at studies, they will also show that if you are struggling with depression, consuming social media exacerbates it, not to mention the mental health effects of just living on your phone and disconnecting from in-person communication, which is obviously, those of us who engage in it know, is richly rewarding.
Right. And even though this youngster, Madison, her parents were totally aware, some of her friends were, they did have her meet with a counselor during the break. And I don't know, we don't know, right, whether they diagnosed her or what she did. And to this day, it's hard to really understand why she went over the line. Do you feel you understand that now, even after writing this book?
I mean, I knew from the outset her parents and her friends were like, we're willing to talk with you about everything, but you're not going to get that one why. And, you know, of course, being a journalist at the beginning, I'm like, no, I'm going to get there. I'm going to figure this out.
Yeah, find out what happened.
But I mean, there is no why. I mean, as you mentioned, like, she did mention suicidal thoughts in her last therapy session. But they were also in the middle of trying to find her a therapist as she went back to Philly. And there was this constant belief that there would be more time. There was certainly an awareness that something was wrong, but as her parents just repeatedly said, we thought we had more time. We thought, like, yes, we know this is serious and let's figure it out, but this is not like we need to figure this out today. And I think that you can understand that as a parent. You're like, my kid's been happy, seemingly happy for 18 years. It's been a couple bad months. We'll figure this out.
Right, which is normal. That's what, as I'm reading the book, I kept thinking, they'll get it. They'll do something.
Yeah. And they were doing everything they could. I think the next step that they were talking about was, you know, getting her on something because they truly believed it was probably a brain chemical change. But, you know, that takes a couple therapy sessions and figuring it out. And, like, Madison didn't really give them that amount of time that I think they thought that they had. And so that's where it becomes so tragic, because it's not as if they didn't have any concept of what was happening.
Right.
It was simply, like, certainly in retrospect, you're like, do this, do that. But at the time, it felt like they were doing everything they could.
Right. I kept thinking about that poor family, her siblings and friends, feeling responsible in many ways. Like, how could they not know that she was literally at this edge? Do you think, having now not only written the book, but really spent a lot of time talking to people, researching Kate Fagan, that this transition from high school to college is a really tough time for a lot of kids, and that every parent, whether your child is an athlete or not, should be made aware of this? What should they do?
I think the messaging to kids who are in high school and are lucky enough to go to college needs to shift. I think there needs to be a conversation for every parent directly with their kid about, yes, this is exciting and, like, it's your first, you know, opportunity to live on your own, but that will also come with possibly, you know, some homesickness that could morph into something more. I think the messaging we've always had to kids is college is the best time and it's awesome.
Right.
And I always think back on how I think all of us have that experience where we go away to camp for the first time when we're like 10 or 11, and you know that acute homesickness.
Right, you're lonely and scared.
Yeah, and I think you think when you're 17 that you're past that, and yet it really ends up being that same kind of, for a lot of kids, feeling, but then coupled with it, you're supposed to be an adult. So you don't want to admit it, and you want to figure it out on your own, and I think that's where there can be a lot of trouble. And so to me, it's just like opening up the conversation more as your kid goes off to college, being like, let's talk about this. It's okay if you're struggling. It doesn't have to be you just like going out there and conquering the world. Like, let's be open and let's keep the conversation lines open.
And so much of it, again, falls back to social media, where that's what kids think they are, and that's their message. Missing reality. Kate Fagan, a new book, a very important book, I think, for every parent to read. If this child had such struggles, it's really important to be aware of signs and be able to communicate with your own. What Made Maddie Run? Thank you, Kate.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All the best to you, Kate Fagan. I'm Joan Hamburg for WABC.